At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
That's the, I mean, beauty of a bear market, but also really beauty of Web3, right? That you build much more in the open, that sure. There is this level of collaboration that, quite frankly, in a traditional company, right, we would have been so protective of like what we're building, right? And you don't want anyone to know. And I think that's been a big shift for us, but I can already, even in this kind of early stage of our journey, see the benefits from that.
This episode of Untold Stories is sponsored by SafePal and AngelBlock. You'll hear more about them later on in this episode.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. What is up, everyone? I am your host, Charlie Schrem, and you're listening to another epic episode, hopefully watching too, of Untold Stories. We're together twice a week. We get to dive deep with some of crypto's most influential leaders to truly understand how this movement came to be. I am your host, Charlie Schrem. I've been around the Bitcoin and crypto space for over 10 years. I've done a lot of crazy things. And now I like to take the time and sit with some really cool people and to talk about cycles, to talk about what products they're building, some really cool stories of how they got into the space and who they first met and all these different things. And I'm really excited to have on the show today Renee Reinsberg. Renee, you're the president of the Celo Foundation. And we've heard a lot of amazing things about Celo. Like, I think you guys are trying to introduce crypto to everyone who owns a smartphone by using phone numbers as public keys. And I think like having that as a basis of helping the transition from like Web 2 to Web 3, a lot of people look at that as a very positive thing. So thanks for coming on the show and talking to us today. What did you do before crypto?
Yeah, and Charlie, it's great to be on. Looking forward to our chat. So I approached my career sort of by, you know, just trying everything out there that I thought might be interesting. So I did a lot of internships even during college, trying different things, ended up working at Morgan Stanley out of grad school in fixed income capital markets, sort of structuring derivatives, mostly interest rates, a little bit of FX, some credit every now and then. And then from there, you know, this was in London, going halfway around the world, lived in Latin America for a while, spent time in Guatemala, Venezuela, working more sort of kind of in the social enterprise sector, also spending some time consulting for the World Bank. Ultimately what pulled me, or when I sort of looked up and asked myself what I want to do with my life, I really realized that I was happiest as an entrepreneur. And so I applied to MIT and luckily got in, and I had one goal, which was really just to find co-founders, find sort of the team to, you know, build something amazing with. And I was lucky. I found Merrick. He and I started a company out of MIT with a few other folks. Sepp actually was our first advisor and later independent board member of that company. And yeah, when we went back to the drawing board after selling the company and working at the acquirer for a few years, we said, you know, this worked so well, let's do something else together. And kind of started with a lot of ideas that ultimately led to what has now become Cello.
It's such a beautiful thing. And you ended up, you know, like you also got an MBA out of it too. You forget that.
You know, it's funny. MBAs are a funny thing. I mean, I was probably the most atypical MBA student. Actually, that's not true because MIT is a bit of a chaotic place. And I mean, it's in a really good way. You kind of just get to do what you want. You know, there's obviously rules and you have to attend certain classes, but you also have a lot of freedom. So I spend a lot of time at CSAIL, at the Media Lab. I, you know, sat in on pretty random, weird classes, but met like tons of really interesting people. And I mean, this is kind of how I met Merrick at the time. We took a class together, which was actually the first class, if I remember correctly, that Sir Tim Berners-Lee was teaching. And it was called Linked Data Ventures. This is the original Web3 before we all decided to call crypto Web3. And it was really interesting because a lot of the concepts of sort of the linked data semantic web in terms of giving people control over their data and, you know, breaking down some of those big data silos, you know, that existed already back then, map to what, you know, I think a lot of us are looking for in Web3 now. And I think at the time, no one was that, well, was, I mean, at least not the people that I was talking to, was thinking about how this could be applied to value. It was much more around data and information. But the parallels are pretty striking. And, you know, ultimately, when we kind of took a look at Ethereum and everything that was happening back when we started Cello, it was like, wow, there's a lot of parallels here. And that got us excited.
Do you need to have a good grades to get to go back to school, like an MBA or PhD or something like that? I just, when I went to college, into university, I was like, I had a startup and it was actually my Bitcoin startup. It was in my junior year, but I had another startup before my freshman year. And I just like looked at college and the college courses as like a startup that I would just try to barely get by. So I looked, I was like, what do I need to do to graduate and never go? And that's kind of what I did. And I graduated with my degrees, but now looking back, I wish I want to learn more and I want to like spend the time in school and meet some cool people. But I still don't have the GPA to potentially get into a good school. So I'm always wondering if like they can look at your, like what you do and stuff like that instead of what you're, I'm not a good standardized test taker.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, I mean, tests are certainly, you know, we're a part of it, but
I hate tests.
I think with MBAs particularly, I think, especially the more entrepreneurial schools, right? They're looking for sort of, is this person passionate about something, right? Are they going to come into this program and they're going to like really use it as an opportunity to do something great after. And I wasn't the obvious candidate for an MBA program. I, you know, studied business before and like I'd done a bunch of random things. I remember like I had one meeting with the career office at MIT, which I was forced to go in the first semester of the MBA. And they looked at my resume and they're like, yeah, we're going to have a very hard time placing you. You've like, you know, really? You've not held on to a job. You've done all these different things. And like, yeah, no, I'm not.
It's called throwing things at the wall to see what sticks. That's what you should be doing in your 20s and 30s.
I'm like, thank you. That's, you know, that's exactly. I was like, that's okay. You know, that's not why I'm here. I don't want to go to McKinsey. I don't want to go to Morgan Stanley. I tried those things and they're fun, but they're not for me. I'm happiest when I can sort of build with a bunch of people that are equally ambitious, crazy, whatever you want to call it. So, so that was fine. I mean, you know, like the MIT community, I mean, obviously super entrepreneurial. So, you know, that, I felt I fit right in, but Yeah, I think if you want to go back to school, man, yeah, go for it. It's like, yeah, you right. know, it's yeah.
So if we rewind back, actually now I was thinking about my school days, if we rewind back to like the early days of Bitcoin, it's 2010. The financial system around the world is very fractured, but it was even more fractured back then. But looking through like the only Bitcoin lens, back then, most people outside of the United States and really outside of Western Europe were using their cell phone companies and their minutes as currency, especially in Africa. When I went to Morocco and then down to South Africa, but also all and all these other places like Egypt and everywhere, they're using, and you have like M-Pesa and all these different, but I'm looking at it just through the Bitcoin lens, just through money. Mm-hmm. But what you've done with Celo, if you've almost, you've created this whole, you have the Celo dollar, the Celo euro, and the Brazilian real, like stable coins built into the network, but you've almost created the ability to have like decentralized applications being built on top of this network at the same time. Why?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And we certainly started, like to us, microtransactions, so micropayments, peer-to-peer payments, felt like the obvious starting point. And we actually, in the sort of early Celo days, with the team, went to Kenya and just try to really study what was working well with M-Pesa. And, you know, it's used by, you know, over 90% of the population, certainly has pretty big benefits, right, in its existence, but it also has shortcomings. And so the costs, right, of like actually making transfers or using it are still comparatively high. And what it hasn't done is it hasn't kind of created a richer infrastructure kind of around it, right, in terms of other financial services, right? So if you're an M-Pesa user, that, like that sort of, you know, you being kind of just a good user, exactly, it's not giving you access to credit, absolutely. And so for us, you know, early on, like we, and that it's obviously like it works really well in Kenya, right, but it hasn't taken off in some other markets where it's been deployed, and certainly mobile money solutions like M-Pesa don't exist in every community country of the world. So it felt to us that, you know, really Web3 protocols in the future would become sort of the infrastructure for global payments. And that in itself felt, you know, super compelling. But then also seeing it as a starting point for, okay, fast forward a few years, right? When most people in a community have a wallet, well, suddenly you can do so much more, right? Like a humanitarian organization could decide to just give everyone a basic income. Someone could come in and say, hey, you know, based on sort of the transaction data, it's, you know, can be like fully anonymized, right? It doesn't have to actually even be tied to the individual, but could basically deploy lending services on top of that. And so seeing that, given the openness, given sort of the permissionless nature of these protocols, that this could become a starting point for something much bigger, definitely was really compelling. And, you know, this is called Untold Stories. One story that I think, you know, it's fun to talk about, like, you know, what motivated us to start working on Celo. But I think the much bigger story, going back to sort of the early Celo days, is not actually about us three founders and sort of our ideation process and then, you know, starting something. But it's, if I go back in time, this is like late 2019. So at this point, we had been working on, I mean, the starting point was we had built a wallet on Ethereum just to have something that we could show people, put in front of people, get feedback and sure, see what was working, what wasn't working. And then, you know, fast forward 2 years, like fall 2019, we were gearing up for mainnet launch of what had then become the Celo protocol, you know, first proof of stake EVM chain, you know, a lot of the features that have now become sort of popular in terms of, like, you know, certainly the phone number mapping that you talked about in the intro. And we said, okay, there's a bunch of people who had at the time heard about that we were working on this. And we had certainly, you know, attended conferences and, you know, so we were like, hey, you know, the network is not live yet, but why don't we just bring a bunch of people that also care about, you know, having a better payments infrastructure, some of these kind of additional use cases that, you know, if we squint, we could see come in the future, and let's all bring them together. And, you know, we basically kind of booked a farm up in Mendocino, Northern California, and invited the people that we knew were similarly excited about this kind of stuff. And, you know, about 60, 70 people showed up. And again, this is like pre-mainnet in like the deep kind of crypto winter, right? So not like necessarily like a great time for these kind of gatherings. But I look back to this now and, you know, I mean, a bunch of the people from that attended, who at the time were, some of them were students, some of them were working on other stuff, were entrepreneurs, like having other like more traditional Web2 ventures, ended up, you know, really like at that point saying, yeah, this Celo mission, I can get behind this and I want to be a part of building this. Probably the most prominent example is Impact Market, which is one of the biggest dApps on Celo. And, you know, for us, UBI, or like the ability to really have kind of a protocol that would allow for permissionless deployment of, you know, large scale basic income social dividend programs in any community of the world, right, anywhere where there's internet, to anyone with a phone, that was a key driver for us starting to work on Celo. But like, you know, without Marco, who ended up coming to the event and then starting Impact Market, I don't think we would even have the bandwidth up until now to really start thinking about how to build this, right? And so
isn't that beautiful? Bear market, that's bear fruit.
That's the beauty of a bear market, but also really beauty of Web3, right? That you build much more in the open, that sure, there is this level of collaboration that, quite frankly, in a traditional company, right, we would have been so protective of like what we're building, right? And you don't want anyone to know. And I think that's been a big shift for us, but I can already, even in this kind of early stage of our journey, see the benefits from that.
Hey guys, I want to take a second and talk to you about our newest sponsor, AngelBlock.io. It's about that time in the bear market that we actually have to take a look at which projects have taken the do's and the don'ts from all the previous waves, bull and bear markets that we've had, and build out real decentralized projects that are going to be successful and take this blockchain and crypto world that we're into the next level. Traditional fundraising is very clunky, and traditional investing in crypto is very clunky as well. I know, I'm a VC at Druid Ventures. AngelBlock is really, really cool, and it's a new DeFi protocol that's solving not only the issues of fundraising for digital assets, but more compliance, transparency, real decentralization. They have on-chain governance, staking, lending, secondary marketplaces for the trading of tokens, all these different ways that you can actually interact with the startup and the token and the project that you're actually investing in. There's a whole community here. AngelBlock is that new compliant platform that's safe and easy to use in order to weed out all the scams. It's so cool. It's built on top of Ethereum, but it's multi-chain by design. They'll also be involved in the mentoring process. There's a phenomenal community that AngelBlock has built. It doesn't cost anything. Go check out the community. Go to their website, angelblock.io. Sign up to their email to stay up to date. You'll have a chance to win some really cool AngelBlock NFTs. And this is only for Untold Stories listeners. Thank you, guys.
It's really exciting. And talking about the founding and the early stories and everything like that. And now that we're in the same type of bear market, and people are always asking, you know, retail is always last. So like, is the world recession going to be the last thing that affects? Because the crypto bear market, we've been going through it for like over a year now. So, you know, on that cycle thought process, you and your team, what are you guys building and launching now, and for who?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, and I forget, I think it was Katie Hahn, I saw her recently say this on Bloomberg, and she has been an early backer of Celo and has become a brand over this journey. And she, I think she said something very important. This is not like other bear markets in a sense that, you know, it's coming alongside a major global, kind of crisis, both economically, and then, you know, we have a war in Ukraine, right? So
yeah,
it's really, yes, there are definitely parallels, but also this is a unique cycle. And so I think the conversations that I have with founders in the ecosystem is, okay, you know, really try to get as lean as possible, you know, and, you know, a lot of teams have really hunkered down, deeply focused on product, right? Making kind of like using this kind of to iterate on the product experience, not getting distracted, right? And basically being ready for, I think, when the next cycle comes, right? It's likely that this will be the one that really pushes us into mass adoption. I think we got close in the last one in terms of maybe the awareness, right? I think certainly NFTs, everybody like knows what an NFT is, which is amazing, right? In terms of like getting awareness for a technology and a product. And I think a lot of people have experienced NFTs. But I think that's still like, you know, there's still a few steps more, I think, that we want people to kind of go in terms of being very just kind of, you know, feeling very good about using a non-custodial wallet, right? And maybe like interacting with some protocols. And I think that's something that when I see a lot of teams in this bear market, they're kind of looking, okay, how do we abstract some of this stuff away and really create user experiences that just make that so easy, right? And in a way, like, not just compete with sort of traditional Web2 experiences, but really leapfrog, because in many markets, you know, you don't even have, say, like a good lending experience, right? So that to me is, I think, one thing. I do, you know, I like you asked about the macro environment. Yeah. I think, to me, what has been interesting in this bear market too, and this is different from last time. Last time, I mean, I don't know, were there actually any applications that, you know,
no,
you could
not
use?
Really.
Not really, right? So it was
hypothetical.
Yeah. Whereas this time, I mean, we were seeing this, right? I mean, like I just mentioned Impact Market, right? I mean, we have a lot of projects that are, you know, that have started serving real people in this last cycle. And, you know, those real people still want to consume those, you know, products, right? So whatever markets like cycle we're in from a crypto crisis perspective, that doesn't sort of temper down, you know, there's people often like don't even necessarily know or care that it's crypto under the hood, but it's just kind of used as sort of an infrastructure to facilitate the applications that people have launched, right? And another example would be something like Ethic Hub, which is offering, you know, basically giving small scale farmers access to kind of the global kind of, you know, loan market, right? And give them financing. Or you could look at a lot of the stuff that's happening in ReFi with carbon offsets, right? Tokenized carbon offsets, bringing those on chain, having companies, you know, think about like instead of going sort of through traditional agents, OTC markets, having a lot more transparency and getting those directly on chain. And so that stuff is all so not tied to like the ups and downs of like where's Bitcoin, where's ETH today, where's Stellar trading, right? But that has real utility to the users.
Do you think the whole token aspect of these things will probably go back into the very niche world potentially, because using a token is like a way to onboard users or to like teach people or have them touch crypto may not be something that we're really doing anymore. Now it's like, hey, we're building products and services for the real world now. And like you said, you can do really cool things with humanitarian. You can work with hurricanes. We're talking about, you mentioned the invasion of Ukraine. We had the founder of the Ukraine DAO on my show a few episodes ago. So it's like, we're really building out some really cool things for the industry. It's just when from the time that Bitcoin launched up until 2020, the world, there was no reason for people to keep cash in their bank accounts. Interest rates were low and people were willing to invest more in riskier assets because there was nowhere else to keep money. Now we have to really pull our pants up and have our products and services compete with the traditional products and services that people are already used to using. So it's like, hey, M-Pesa is the way we're doing it and Celo is cool, but now it needs to be, Celo needs to be able to compete with M-Pesa, whoever you're competing with, and to be better than and build on top of the blockchain.
Absolutely. And, you know, those worlds are blending too, right? I mean, we have major telcos, and you know, we spend a lot of time with telcos given the mobile first approach, and a lot of the features, right, I think play really into also how telcos are thinking about how they're entering Web3. And you know, Deutsche Telekom has been an early backer, is running validators on the Celo network, right? And whether it's them or an organization like Kickstarter, who announced that they want to decentralize, right? And they also picked Celo as a chain. So I'm close to that as another example where it's no longer necessarily even just like some upstart kind of small startup has to figure out how to compete with, you know, or like have sort of the Web3 version of a Kickstarter, but it's Kickstarter itself is basically working on creating the protocols, right, that can open up sort of opportunities and bring this to many more people around the world. And I think that's also, I think, different from last cycle, where we certainly had headlines in the last cycle of big corporations entering Web3, but for the most part, those have stayed headlines, right? And this time around, there's engineering teams. There's, you know, really this has become a topic of discussion at the C level, at boards, you know. And I think that makes sense too, right? I mean, technology is much further. We have on and off ramps in many more markets. It's become a lot easier to use wallets, right? So I think from where we are in sort of the cycle for the technology too, this is a really interesting time. But with that said, it's interesting because I think that's a lot when we kind of map what are the things that are going to work and what are the use cases, right? We come at it with our thinking of, oh, like what's a better M-Pesa going to look like, right? And or what's going to be, you know, how do you kind of provide a better lending experience? But then you also have these completely new type of products, right, or experiences which don't even exist today. And I think that's really the opportunity for a lot of new projects, right, to kind of go and say, hey, look, you know, why shouldn't someone in you know, anywhere in the world be able to create a digital good, right? And like through that kind of make a living, right? It could be art, could be music, right? Could be that's something that until now just people weren't even thinking about that, right? That was just so far from what's possible with the existing tech stack.
Guys, I am so excited to talk about our newest presenting sponsor, SafePal. SafePal is an all-in-one solution. You got a beautiful hardware wallet. You have this amazing fireproof Cypher. You got a mobile wallet, an extension wallet similar to MetaMask. You're talking about an all-in-one solution for all of your crypto needs. Founded in 2018, SafePal is a Binance Labs-backed Singapore-based company, the venture arm, where their mission is to make crypto secure and simple for everyone. You got cross-chain swapping, trading services, and more. SafePal supports over 40 different blockchains. I mean, check this out. Look at this. If you back up your private seed in this beautiful metal SafePal backup here and you keep it in your safe, fires or water or nothing degrading over time, you should not be backing up your crypto on pieces of paper. I mean, look at this. Look at the S1 here. It's so cool. This is the hardware wallet. I'm just used to using the Trezor or the Ledger wallet, but SafePal is a lot better because not only do you get the hardware wallet and the backup cipher, but you also get the mobile wallet, the extension on your Google Chrome or whatever Firefox you use. So it all works together. You don't have to worry about man-in-the-middle attacks and everything like that. You can go to safepal.com, use the coupon code Charlie, and you'll get any of these amazing products. The extension wallet is free, the mobile wallet is free, the hardware wallet and the backup are really, really well priced. It's all super safe and secure, and I love it. I mean, there's no other way you should be using your crypto than SafePal. It's crazy. It's just like, I'm looking up these metrics here, but it's, I'm constantly thinking from like a US perspective. And really, you're working in some of these emerging countries, and some really not emerging countries, some like, you know, countries with a very high what do they call it, like the development index, the human development index, like the, you know, the quality of life, one country to the next. Like, you're working in some of the, like, it's like in Kenya, you brought that up, 90%, I think it's 90% crypto adoption, where in the United States, it's like so much lower. So it's like just another thing that, that myself in like a Western country that I'm taking for granted is that we're starting to see fractures now in 2022 of, you know, the Western financial systems. We're seeing it with the energy prices. You see with the UK, you know, the UK pension fund needs to get reinsured and backstopped. There's some like huge cracks. Like if you, if the world financial system was a seawall, you'd be like checking some of these cracks and holes right now. So, and it, and you're out there building out the technologies for everyone else. So I really, hats off to you, because you're probably seeing huge adoption rates all over the world.
Yeah, I will say, look, definitely you're right that there's what's driving adoption for these real world use cases often is like, hey, there's no other alternative right now, right? I couldn't even get a loan if I went to a bank. And so it makes sense that in some of these markets, in a way, crypto is, you know, is kind of leapfrogging sort of the traditional financial system or mobile applications. And but, you know, I think the important piece here is that it kind of needs to be global, right? I think the, this sort of notion of, hey, let's just build for the global south is a little harder to pull off, right? Because I think that connectivity between global north and south is important, right? You would want to, you want to be able that if someone, you know,
and then one internet,
you know, you can exactly, yeah, you want to be able to send money from the US to Brazil, right, and Kenya, and it should happen in a couple seconds, and it should cost less than a cent, and that's possible today, right? But if you only focus on like the global south, I think you end up in a less optimal setup, right? And so a lot of the projects were, you know, that we see, they often will focus on a few markets to kick things off, but then really thanks to kind of Web3, right, like they and also kind of all the other projects and sort of members of sort of the community, right, that provide, say, on and off ramps in various markets, right, you can actually with a very small team launch a global product, right, whether that's in payments.
That's my favorite part of globalization, right there, is that like you don't have to look for your, I take that for granted, don't have to, like when you're starting a new company in crypto or in tech or whatever, you don't have to like look for people in your city. You have the whole world at your disposal.
Yeah. And that's an advantage too, right? Because you want the person who is on the ground, right? In Colombia. I mean, I'm just thinking of a project that comes to head. I just was talking to the founder last week and he is in Colombia. He's building a lending product for Venezuelan refugees who, because they're, you know, like,
yeah,
and they have
do?
Like, they had amazing, you know, financial credit scores in Venezuela, but guess what? In Colombia, they start at zero, right? And so for them, like, yeah, they're, you know, this is kind of the only way, really, right? And they want to build businesses, right? They want to be members of society, and but without sort of on the ground, it'd be very hard to launch that kind of product from, you know, an office in South Park, San Francisco, right? Or Brooklyn, New York, right? You have to be on the ground. You have to be in Bogota. You have to be there. You have to meet the people. And that's the beauty, right? You can do that while still plugging into sort of that global community network. And I think that's an often overlooked, I think, factor as well. I think we often talk about Web3 being so global, but it only works because we have founders that really are everywhere, right? That are in the markets. And one thing that I'm at the Celo Foundation, right? And at the Celo Foundation, the big thing is like, how do we support people in the ecosystem? And over time, we want to get out of the way, right? It's kind of like similar to Ethereum Foundation, like this theory of subtraction, right? We don't want to like have this important role, but we want to just help people kind of do their thing, right? And support them as best as we can. And one thing that from the beginning was a big focus was how do we bring more capital to like Nairobi, right? To Bogota, to Manila, to Buenos Aires, right? And I think what we started doing was initially just, you know, basically wrote LP checks into funds that are, you know, in those countries. But more recently, we've become a little more aggressive in the sense that we're going out there and we're really trying to talk to all the investors, all the funds, and we're saying, hey, look, you know, and I was just last week, I was at this kind of big gathering of impact investors in Den Haag. It's like, you know, the people there collectively manage like $1 trillion, right? And it's some of the familiar names that then also have impact funds and some more kind of just dedicated impact funds. But for them to make the leap into Web3, that's still a big hurdle, right?
Because of course it is. It's the biggest hurdle.
Technology, it's new, it's unknown. They read the headlines, right? And so, but to me, that's the big opportunity, right? If we start seeing some of that capital flowing into the projects, right, that are on the ground, having a direct impact, no middleman, full transparency, right? That's how we, I think, that's when we start really delivering against the initial promise of Web3.
I agree. Well, Renee, sorry to cut you short, but it's all the time we have for today. Renee Reinsberg, I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on Untold Stories from the Celo Foundation, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Charlie. Good talking.
I'll see you later.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.